Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Chisako Res, Chair of the Club Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Dr. Stuart Brown is a medical doctor, psychiatrist, clinical researcher, and the founder of the National Institute for Play. A former clinical director at Mercy Hospital and Medical Center in San Diego, as well as associate professor at the University of California, San Diego. He speaks regularly to Fortune 500 companies and groups across the country about the importance of play in our lives. Dr. Brown, who produced a three-part PBS series on play, has appeared on NPR and was featured in a front-page cover story in the New York Times Magazine. He lives in Carmel Valley, California. Please help me welcome Dr. Stuart Brown.
Thanks, Chisako, for that very generous introduction. It's really a pleasure to be in this historic spot and talk to you about what I think of as a timeless and perennially misunderstood subject, namely the subject of play. And you'll see on the screen an image which says play plus science equals transformation. And I think we are at a time when there is an undergirding of scientific evidence which is more and more showing how significant play behavior is. And I will hope in the course of our rapid run-by of play tonight, all of you will have a little better idea about play in your own lives and play and its importance in the universe itself as a subject that is considerably misunderstood. I'm going to show you a sequence of pictures which have been fairly commonly shown, namely a picture of a polar bear that's wild approaching a sled dog in the wilds of Manitoba along Hudson Bay. And this wild male polar bear weighs 1,200 pounds, is hungry, and those onlookers who saw this, namely a photographer who was doing a series for a German magazine on sled dogs in the subarctic, felt that this sled dog that's facing the polar bear, as you see it in this image, was about to have a very short existence. However, if you look more closely at this picture, you'll see that the two of them are exchanging soft glances. And just before this picture was snapped, the sled dog was in a play bow with her tail wagging, giving a signal to this bear about what was about to occur, namely that the two of them were going to look softly at each other, exchange play signals, and begin a marvelous ballet of mutual play. Here's a 100-pound husky or sled dog, 1,200-pound polar bear, both carnivores, and they begin a really remarkable in-nature bout of play. How could this be? But it is. And if you'll look more closely at an image like this, where the sled dog has her throat open to the fangs of the bear, and you look at the look in the eyes of the bear seen more closely in this image, and you'll see that they are in a really separate state of being. They are in a state of play. And this state, which is common to all social mammals, is also something we can access, as can most other animals or humans, given the opportunity and the signals and the safety to enact this behavior. So here you see a process that the play behaviorists would call handicapping, where a large animal continues to play with a smaller one because they both allow a differential in power not to interrupt their play. And look at the softness and look at the in the eyes as they end their play bout, which lasted about 20 minutes this first time, continued nightly for 2 weeks when the ice came back into Hudson Bay and the bear went out and began to once again be a carnivore on seals, which is their main source of nutrient. And here is a picture of a courtyard in the 16th century in Eastern Europe, which depicts 64 different kinds of play. A close-up of this will show a little more detail. And I would say if we go to a mall today, we're not having nearly as much fun as these folks were in a courtyard in the 16th century. The point of this is that play is a common, deep element of social mammals, of which we are supposedly the king of play. So if I talk to a group of engineers, for example, and they insist that I define what play is before I get any further, I will do so with some resistance. But here is an image on the screen which says play is directed by the players, it's voluntary, it produces freedom from time, it appears purposeless, it has improvisational potential, it is inherently fun, that goes without saying. It produces a diminished consciousness of self, and there's a continuation for it to want to keep on going. So this is an imperfect definition of play, just like we all have an imperfect definition of love. But as the co-author in the audience, Chris Vaughn, has coined in our book, defining play is like shooting down a bird of paradise in flight. So I'm defining it so any engineers in the group can continue to listen. But otherwise, let's just let it be an experience. Where does play begin? Here is an image of a mother and an infant, a polar bear and her offspring. And here is a primate with that deep gaze that's so radiant between mother and infant, and a human mother looking rapturously into the eyes of her infant and the infant looking back. And with us humans, I say this is the beginning point for play. When the eye contact is made and that baby's old enough for a radiant social smile, a really remarkable thing happens. The baby becomes radiant, begins to goo and curdle, and the mother starts talking baby talk, and this is a hardwired phenomenon. This is the grounding base of play. This is the joyous beginning. Where the state of play, which is common to all of us when we're safe and well-fed, has its beginning. And as we go through the discussion tonight, I want you to think of this as the foundation of play, but that whether it's one sort of play or another, the state that's there, this joyous state, is available to all of us if we access it. Here's another image of the mother and infant a little farther along. And I put this image up as a multiple lead electroencephalogram, because if we get a bit scientific about what's going on in play, we'll find that mother and infant at the moment of that joyous union will have the right side of their brain cortex in attunement with each other. The electroencephalogram readings of each will show a rhythmic harmony, and that harmony is exclusive to play and is as being followed more and more by researchers as part of our ability to begin to more clearly biologically define what play is. Now, there are ways of organizing play, and one of the ways is to begin to look at it in its various forms. Body play is a pretty common form of play. It's fun. Here's a young baby in a tub having a great time. A mountain goat leaping into the air. This produces a sense of joy. There is this inherent urge to rise upward, to jump upward, and I think perhaps the reason we fly and have astronauts to the moon may be at its core a play impulse. Also, if you were having a particularly difficult day, start skipping and jumping up and down in the street, and I guarantee you you'll feel better. And part of the definition that I gave you of play, namely that it's purposeless, is demonstrated by this hippo who in the foreground is doing a backflip. Now, why would a hippo do a backflip unless it was fun? You know, most biologists like to think of something as being purposeful. Well, I think the purpose of this is playful and fun. And if we were able to hook on to the brain of that rapidly growing hippo, we probably would see that a lot of very good things are happening at the same time the backflip is taking place. And here is a picture of a young man in flight over a pile of leaves. And I show this close up because I want you to see his face, which I think duplicates in large measure the face of the polar bear. Here he is in midair, having a wonderful time playing with his body. This is just a little broader picture of the same thing. And here is a picture of an orang upside down, swinging like a pendulum in the water. The reason I put this here is I would like you to take a look in the corner of the orang's mouth. You'll see a Michael Jordan tongue sticking out just like Michael Jordan when he's on a roll for a basket at the finals of the NBA. We see parallels in play throughout the animal and human worlds. This is a shot of skydivers taken from our Promise of Play series. I don't think that's play for everyone, but it is for them. And I show this image of this young man about to go down a ramp because the idea that play should be free is an important one, but there are clear boundaries for safety and reasonableness that are part of parenting and part of the story of play. Here's a young man climbing a more than vertical pitch on a mountain. Play for him, again, it's not play for everyone, but these are examples of strenuous body play, which is one form we can think of as being playful. And then there's object play. Given a chance, this polar bear will play with his tire and most anything else that it can get its paws on. And here is a Japanese monkey with a snowball. Part of the essence of understanding your surroundings when you've got digits and hands is to manipulate the environment, and there's pleasure in doing that. Here is one of Jane Goodall's young chimpanzees where the use of a stem is initially a toy and then it becomes a tool. And I think the extrapolation of this beyond toy to tool to computer to whatever else, to me, is a grounding, part of the grounding reason that play is so significant. And there's joy in making things. And I put this image of the hand up because one of our advisors in the National Institute for Play, a man by the name of Frank Wilson, has written a book on the hand. And Frank has taught a lot of us a great deal about hand-brain play. And Frank and a master mechanic by the name of Nate Jones got together serendipitously because Nate had found out as a teacher of mechanics in a high school in Long Beach that his students were having difficulty fixing cars. They couldn't figure out how to do it. And he felt it was because they no longer were working with their hands, and he tried to write a book about it, and in the struggles of writing his book, he came across Frank's book, realized Frank knew more than he did. They got together. They wrote an article. Jet Propulsion Laboratory, one of the heads of Jet Propulsion Laboratory, read the article, realized that he was having problems hiring master researchers who were good problem solvers, didn't know why, and then began to recognize that those who were leaving for retirement had been hand tinkerers, whether they were conceptual problem solvers or engineers. And so Frank and JPL and Nate got together, and now there are some, not only JPL and NASA, but other corporations that are dealing with research and development problem solvers, recognize that one of the ways to improve problem solving is to really mess around with your hands a lot. So hand-brain coevolution and play with one's hands is significant, and this is just one of many things that's in the book that I think can be taken to more detail. Now there's exploratory and curiosity that are part of play. This young leopard is looking at a tortoise, not sure that tortoise is safe or not, tentative. But as soon as there's a recognition that this tortoise isn't going to hurt the leopard, the tortoise becomes a toy. Not much fun for the tortoise, but great fun for the leopard. And exploration is a part of continuing play. This is anatomic exploration. between a young man and his mother, and it certainly is a part of play. I love this next part of play because I think it's so accessible to all of us at all parts of our lives. We tend to think of pretend and imaginative play as being largely for kids, but imagine this young man who's dressed in an Aquanaut uniform with a Superman cape, and he's anything he wants to be, and he's pretending actively, and what a wonderful mix between reality and growth of one's own imagination should never, ever be beyond us at any stage in our life. Same thing with this young lady. She is thinking and thinking about a story that's just her own through her own imagination. And in literature, there's some wonderful events that I think exemplify the importance of imaginative play. This is Heidi, illustration in the book Heidi, when she has safely come back to her grandfather, is once again enveloped in love and safety and is imagining wonderful things. Secret spaces for all of us at points in our youth and in our adulthood allow imaginative flurries of fantasy to take place, and they're an important part of our ability to adapt to a changing world. Social play. We could go on forever on this. There is a natural history of social play, which begins with parallel play. Not much involvement of these two young ladies with each other, but they're playing together. Their parents think it's wonderful and think they're great, deep friends. If you listen to the banter between the two of them, they're still pretty solo, but they're beginning to bond to one another. A little farther along the trail, developmentally, play becomes much more bonded, and the sense of belonging, the roots of community, are established in play behavior. These three young men on a beach obviously are close friends and belong. And if anything is happening to some of the neighborhoods that at least I'm familiar with in an urban setting, is that we are not as bonded as a belonging series of communities as once was perhaps the case. And certainly that picture I showed of Bruegel shows an entire community bonded together in a courtyard. Another example on this in this image of kids belonging through play. Now, this is an incredibly important picture because it's of my son and my two granddaughters, taken, I think, when they were beginning their first surf lesson. They're a little older and a little taller now and have become much more facile, and my son's lost a little more hair, but other than that, it's pretty close to the same picture. So I love this picture, obviously. I'm a proud grandfather. Could spend the rest of our session on rough and tumble play. These are lionesses. At a distance, they looked like they were in a fight, and they almost sounded like they were in a fight. I saw these lionesses from about a quarter of a mile distant, and the National Geographic photographer that was with me snapped this picture. And if you look at it, you can begin to see this is not a fight. This is a separate form of behavior called rough and tumble play. Their eyes are soft, their ears are back, their hair is flat, their claws are retracted. The backbone of each of them is curved. It's not aggressively straightforward, which is a separate form of behavior. And in the process, they're learning their own speed, they're learning the terrain, they're learning their place in the pride. It's an incredibly important component of social mammal play, which we engage in naturally worldwide, but which is probably not very well understood by the average preschool or nursery school teacher as being significant. Here's an example of two kids. You notice that they're pinning each other, but what's the look on their face? They're smiling and they're staying friends. And there actually may be some pain associated with this activity, but the pain's in the context of rough and tumble play and is a part of a play form. This gets a little tougher and a little tougher. And this is not an abnormal part of growth and development. This is a little verbal jousting that occurs as rough and tumble play occurs through the spectrum of development. It's healthy. This is not healthy. This is bullying. And there is a difference. And I certainly think that a consummate bully has no place on a playground and has to be dealt with supervisory adult behavior, because many stories that I have heard in the course of taking play histories are of humiliation and being excluded painfully on a playground, so that not all rough and tumble play that I'm kind of idealizing here is necessarily good. There are dark sides to play. Here is a rat. Now, why in the middle of a talk about play do I throw a rat up here? I like rats. I like rats because they engage in rough and tumble play normally from the age of 4 weeks to about 20 weeks. And the rough and tumble play consists of initially giving a squeak, and then a neck nuzzle, and then mutual pinning. And the reason I like them is that you can control this behavior, being somewhat of a scientist, and find out what happens if you stop it. If you stop only rough and tumble play in rat behavior, they don't grow up to be normal rats. They don't develop the ability to tell friend from foe. They can't mate properly. They don't handle their position in the dominance hierarchy, which rats have. And they grow up deficient. And the people who studied this, a man by Serge Pellis, is the master who has studied rough and tumble play for 30 years, really has been able to show that the presence of rough and tumble play in rats specifically crafts their social brain, gives them a sense of emotional recognition, and is a tremendously important aspect of human behavior. And as we get a little further along, and I talk to you about a little later about how I got into the field of play professionally by studying young murderers, you may understand a little more why I like rats so well. Another thing about rats is that if you take the rat cortex off, that is the higher centers of their brain, you'd think they wouldn't be able to play rough and tumble play. You'd think that highly intricate behavior, squeaking, pinning, nuzzling, comes from pretty high centers of the brain. It doesn't. It emanates from the brain stem. It's a part of a survival apparatus in rat brains, and by all we know about ours, our play impulses also come from these survival centers. This is not a commonly thought of truth about science. And then as you watch the play, urges go up through the brain, they get modified in the higher centers of the brain, the hypothalamus, the hippocampus, the limbic system, get into the cortex where there is feedback and mapping, and this is where culture and gender and age and other things certainly modify play behavior. But the point of this is that I take off from using rough and tumble play as an example, is that play is a survival drive. It's housed in the same areas, respiration, heartbeat, sleep and dreams. And yet that has not been the commonly thought of reservoir for it. So I'll move on a little here now. Here is an example of two young men, two little league players, where competition becomes a part of play and there is a natural history of competitiveness that tends to occur in late juvenile and sub-adult years. And games are a fundamental part of play. If we think of all these, this spectrum of play behavior, its forms are myriad, even though its state may be somewhat similar in each. Celebratory play, this is the moment that the Red Sox won the World Series. May never happen again, but it happened. And if you look at the joy on the faces of the spectators and the players, pretty evident that this is play behavior. Ritual play. This is the Burning Man ceremony some years back. I understand there were 46,000 people in the Black Rock Desert of Nevada this summer for a full week engaged in a highly artistic ritual, a bacchanalia, saturnalia, some of the rules turned upside down. At the end, the man is burned, and it's a very powerful ritual. And if one looks at the history of human play collectively, you'll find ritual play again and again as being present. Narrative play. This is another form of play. Here is a bushman telling a tall tale to a rapt audience. And here is a picture, a personal picture of me telling a story to one of my grandchildren. The urge to be a part of narrative play is a strong part of being human throughout our lifespan. And the richness of narrative is really part of the richness of self. So it's really an important part of play to allow ourselves to engage in narrative, for that narrative to be built on pretended imagination, like I talked earlier, and to allow it its flights of fantasy and fancy to take place. Aesthetic play. I stole this picture from the New York Times because I thought it exemplified a kind of a beauty and symmetry that's a part of play behavior. I think play leads into a lot of very high aesthetic forms, although I can't say that all poetry comes from play, because I think a certain amount of suffering may be necessary for some artistry to take place. But there are bridges between symmetry and form and beauty and fluidity that are part of the natural history of play, which I use this image to at least to speak from. Now, what about the languages of play? Well, you've seen a little with the polar bear and the dog and the lionesses, but there are these incontrovertible play signals that are pre-verbal. When you look at this play bow, this Labrador on the beach, what do you think is going to happen? Is that dog going to bite you? Is the dog going to run away? It's a very clear signal that says what follows this signal is not going to harm you. It's going to be playful. And Mark Beckhoff, who has studied animal signaling in detail and is also very erudite, and a very erudite scholar of morality, feels that the icon of trust between humans and others, between animals and others, is established first and foremost through play signals, and that the importance of these signals is certainly not to be minimized. So here is play chasing is also a fundamental part of play signaling. And we certainly enjoy seeing this in lots of films. I'm thinking of the French Connection and other chase scenes that are very vivid in my imagination. But what's different, perhaps, in nature than from what we tend to think of chasing being all about is that in this case, where these two monkeys are chasing each other, pretty soon the chaser became the chasee. They keep the game going by chasing each other. And no one has to win. And there very often is handicapping, so that the slower one will actually not be overcome by the faster one in order to keep the game going. And here again, cross-species signaling, not too much doubt that these two are jumping rope together, a German shepherd and a young man. And here's another example of the differential in power, a full-grown moose and a kitty cat nosing each other in a playful embrace. And there is Jane Goodall, the primatologist, with one of her friends using vocal signals to signal play. These are just their body signals, there are vocal signals, there are all kinds of different ways, even olfactory signals for play in some aquatic species that signal this is a separate form of behavior that is safe and in and of itself is significant. How about that one? That's John McEnroe. I don't know whether he's playing with us or he's not playing. I'm pretty sure this golfer is not playing, who's breaking I don't know if that's a putter, but look, I can't quite tell because he's got one broken club right below the other one. But I've watched some golfers since I live in a kind of a golf mecca, and occasionally I'll follow some golfers at Spanish Bay Club during the first hole and just listen to them. And maybe one in four or one in three really seems to be joyful. The rest of them are grousing about their shots. So I'm not sure that all golf is fun. That signal is definitely not a play signal. Now, you heard me mention earlier that I got into this professionally, into the business of chasing after play professionally, by studying murders. And this is a picture of the University of Texas Tower. Many years ago, a young man, 25 years old at the time, an architectural engineering student, a former Marine, an Eagle Scout, B-plus student, with no ostensible warning, killed his wife and mother, climbed up the top of the Texas Tower, killed 14 people, wounded 41, before he himself was shot down by vigilante and off-duty police crossfire. Well, I was a young psychiatrist at the time and was given the task of trying to figure out, along with a lot of other individuals who were recruited by the governor and other people in Texas, figure out why this young man did what he did. And so we exhaustively studied his, he was dead because he'd been killed, studied his life in as minute detail as I think could be possibly done. And when we finished that study, what surprised all of us was that the commission itself felt that the progressive and continuous suppression of play behavior was linked to his inability to handle his hostile and violent impulses. And there was more to the story than that. He'd been abused, and his father was very overbearing, and we could spend the rest of our time talking about him. But that sensitized me to the importance, the developmental importance of play, because we had taken his life from prenatal through every moment, and he had diaries and an large extended family, so it was a very rich encyclopedia of his behavior. And then because of that study, I was given a grant to study, do a pilot study of the young murderers in the state of Texas. And it was a relatively small sample of 26. But we studied them in detail. They were alive. We were able to study their families. And we were able to set aside a comparison group of individuals who matched as much as possible the lifestyle and the demography of these young murderers, not expecting at that point that we would find anything like Charles Whitman, the Texas Tower sniper, because he seemed so unique, and that was the largest mass murder, and he was a brooding, smart Eagle Scout, and none of the young murderers that we studied that were both in the prison system and in the state hospital system had that profile. But all of them had aberrant play behavior, either deviant or absent or bullied or associated with abuse. And so out of the woodwork came this profile that indicated that play behavior was somehow really significant. We couldn't and can't now say that it was that every kid who is play deprived is going to be homicidal. That by no means is that the case. But you could see the brittleness and the absence of a repertoire of their ability to handle stress and their difficulty in being resilient under particularly conditions of humiliation and to some degree abuse. And so that set me on the course many years ago to try and figure out what's going on with play anyhow. So over the course of the next 20 plus years, I decided every time I saw a patient, and I was, as you heard in the introduction, I was also chief of service of a hospital, so that I got a chance to take play histories on a number of individuals who were hospitalized and had others that were associated with me do the same, and accumulated about 6,000 active history, play histories of individuals over the course of 20 plus years. And although there is not a no murderers and murderers clear spectrum, there is evidence from those 6,000 that in every life play has a significant role. And it's from that anecdotal background that a lot of my motivation and a lot of the reason that I've continued to search out play and to certainly try and find the scientific basis for play, because its importance and its contributions to me seem absolutely solid. Here's the Texas Tower up close. Gives me creeps to see it again. And here is an example of what occurs in a life, and I want you each to think of your own lives, if they're without play. Well, Brian Sutton Smith, probably the premier play scholar in the world, says that the opposite of play is not work. The opposite of play is depression. And you see here that here are some of the components that occur in a highly play-deprived life. Empathy, diminished lack of empathy, diminished curiosity, predilection to addiction, much more predilection to interpersonal conflict. You can read the images as well as I can talk about them, but there are consequences to play deprivation in any life. Anybody here whose life is entirely work-oriented is going to have some smoldering sense that is life really worth it after all. Play is a necessity, as far as I'm concerned, for vitality and personal health. And there are some things that have to do with play hygiene that I think need to be introduced into common cultural consciousness at all ages. And here is a quick run-by. I'll be through in about 5 minutes, but a run-by of kind of the special design of the human for play. Here we see on the screen four images. The image of a juvenile chimpanzee, an adult mother, and a baby. And the three of these four images have a configuration that's similar as far as their cranium is concerned. The juvenile chimpanzee, the mother, and the baby have a similar rounded, quote, immature head, whereas the adult chimpanzee, which shares 98.5% of our genes, looks very different. A prognathic jaw, big overbearing brow, and their behavior. The adult behavior of the chimpanzee is much more specialized and fixed than that mother's. Here is a baby wolf. Baby wolf has a short muzzle, ears that are not down, and as this wolf develops, it is initially a very playful little character. And at some point, this wolf will be a retriever, just like this Labrador puppy is. The Labrador puppy has a short nose, has ears that are going down. You may think I'm nuts talking about dogs right now, but we're going to get there. And here is the adult wolf, long muzzle, ears upright, more fixed behavior, alpha behavior. Reproduction is restricted by pack dynamics. And though they're cooperative and still playful as adults, nowhere near as much as this 12-year-old Labrador that dies retrieving and playing all the time. Now, if there are any anthropologists in the room, I will apologize for this, but I'm going to say it anyhow. We, human primates, are the Labradors of the primates. We stay immature, we stay playful, we stay plastic in our nervous system, we stay adaptable. It's part of who we are. It's part of our design, and that is really has really come through to me as I look at the importance of play and begin to see how plastic human beings are through their entire life cycle, how important it is for us to play through our life cycle. So this is a part of who we are. And as an example of a kind of a playful character, here's Einstein on his bicycle. I suspect he's pushing 60 at least, maybe more. So here is a kind of a summation of what does a good play life provide us? Well, I've given you some of these things. Think about it. Trust, that opening with the mother and infant. The play signaling that we know is not going to hurt us. Fairness. Mark Beckhoff writes beautifully about the persistence of fairness as a part of play and how we insist as kids on other kids playing fair. This is a part of our morality that's established. The need for optimism, perseverance, an increased desire for mastery as a part of play behavior. You take it to the next level if you're having a good time and you want to learn more. In a culture like ours, it's faced with huge, huge, overpowering challenges. We need to be able to be innovative. And certainly play is the key to innovation. The playful imagination allows this to take place. And although I'm not going to talk much about it here, the ability to handle two conflicting things at the same time, if you think about pretend and real, they're not the same. Play gives us that ability. Emotional competency has certainly come out of the 6,000 play histories, and the rats objectify this in their play behavior. And most importantly, I think, for kids, is for them to recognize that they have through their own innate play behavior, access to the best of their talents. This is what comes from inside them, that comes naturally to them, and which they take to. And for us as parents and teachers and educators, maybe as bosses, the ability to tease what is best in play from each of us, I think, is really important. Show me a couple that plays together, and I'll show you some relational resiliency. Play is a part of that. And one of the things I haven't mentioned, but which is evident in objective measures of rat play, is that there is immense stress relief. If you stress a rat heavily, it's not a playful rat, they don't handle it well. If they're well-played rats, they get over their stress, and there's every evidence that it does some of the same things for us. So, in closing, I'd like to see you, if any of you have lost your play, to rediscover your play nature by taking a close look at your play history, and the book certainly gives you some cues as to how to go about that. And it can be the source of a much better life.
For Bowen White, the most profound moments of the trip came from a visit to an orphanage nursery. Here, 40 infants were lying two to a bed, including six-month-old Kara.
It's a gift to me. It's a gift to myself to be here with Karin. I mean, I'm selfish. Selfish enough to own what I need. And I need this kind of connection. And you don't have to come to San Salvador to do this.
Patch Adams has come to realize that, at the heart of the matter, there is play and love. They both connect us at the deepest level.
We are taking play in our clowning in a much more traditional sense of play. Loud noise, gay abandon, laughing frivolity. But it's incorrect to think that play doesn't have a silent component. Take the child that was in the hospital today. I didn't ask what her problem was, but play made it possible for me to go up and be with her. And there was her father and her. For me, that's play. I am using play to go to the worst possible moment. Play is a connector. Play and love address alienation like a frontal attack.
I don't have to come here to be fully alive. But when you're around people that are suffering, one of the things suffering does, it evokes something in you. You get your heart broken open, and then you see what's inside. I think we started valuing play more. Then what we would probably do would be, we'd be paying attention in new ways with beginner's mind, with the eyes of the child, and see options and possibilities to solve some of the enormous problems that we have. I don't think play is done to the exclusion of ignoring the pain and suffering and unfairness of the world. I think play may help us better deal with it, actually.
As you can tell, I'm kind of professorial, and Chris keeps the language alive and accessible. So thank you very much.
We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Play, How It Shapes the Brain, Opens the Imagination, and Invigorates the Soul, with Dr. Stuart Brown. Our thanks to Dr. Brown for his comments here today. I am Chisako Ress, chair of the Club Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, and I will be moderating today's question period. Now, I'm going to pass around a microphone, and if you have any questions, please raise your hand and wait until you have the microphone, because we are recording today's session. Any questions?
Thank you. Have you found any evidence that indicates, two questions, I guess. Number one, that there can be too much play? And secondly, did you see some sort of work balance play that was ideal for humans?
The answer to the first question is, of course, there can be too much play. When play becomes driven, where, let's say, video game play, for example, where the person is driven and can't extract themselves from that activity to the detriment of personal relationships, food, common health, that's clearly over the line. And I think any time you can't interrupt the behavior from something that's either survival-oriented or very significant, you're probably over the line as far as play. Once you're involved fully in play, you know, you don't want to be interrupted, but the answer to that first question is yes, of course there can be too much play. As far as the work-play balance is concerned, I think there are huge differences in temperament. The primatologists and the anthropologists who are, I respect for being knowledgeable about hunter-gatherer societies, feel that between 10 and 20% of one's energy as an adult is well spent in play. From the 6,000 or so play histories that I've taken, it seems to me that the ideal blend is to find within your work the capacity to regularly experience some play moments, play senses, so that the artificial separation of work and play is less and less and less. And this is not a common cultural precept. It's sort of work and play are separate. I'd rather see them together if it's at all humanly possible.
Thank you.
I have seen pictures in the third world where youngsters at the age of 6 or 7 are put to work, either weaving carpets in the mill, in the fields, and so forth. This must have a great effect in their later adult psychosocial development.
Yes, it does, and I think there are a man by the name of Roberts and Brian Sutton Smith, who I mentioned earlier, have done longitudinal studies of a variety of cultures where kids who are 5, 6 years old are out taking care of cattle or taking care of other kids. And although they play and play a lot, their play is often very much within the confines of what they're doing vocationally. And the intricateness of the play when they have to go to work that earlier, let's say the games of strategy and the games of chance don't happen. So there are some real effects by the third world demands. But there's a lot more play going on there than meets the eye, and this has been really a surprise to me in talking to particularly play behaviorists who are also cultural anthropologists.
Yeah, you picked on the engineers a little bit at the beginning.
Sorry about that.
Do engineers have trouble or difficulty with play?
Not all of them. I think when you get object-oriented and you're in in the demanding undergraduate work that often is so heavy for many engineering curricula, and the maintenance of rules and specificity tends to make free play less easy. But there are certainly plenty of highly playful engineers, and I wouldn't want to done the whole profession. It's just that when I was signing on to, it was actually to go to a major company, and the fellow that signed me on wanted to do a dress rehearsal of my presentation, and I didn't define play. He just said, hey, these guys are going to eat you alive. You've got to define it or they won't listen to you. So that's where that anecdote came from.
Hi. I'm curious, from your research, what sort of the practical implications have been? Have you consulted with educational institutions or corporations? Do you have any examples of how you've applied your learnings?
There are a lot of practical applications. I think I could start with preschool, for example, and sort of work my way through the life cycle. In preschool, it's pretty evident that if a child is given free access to their own imagination and to some of the rough and tumble play I talked about, that their level of imaginativeness and academic readiness is actually better than if they're having flashcards and pressure. So that's, let's say that that's at one level is a practical, if a preschool teacher or parent understands that some of what appears to be anarchy is fairly normal play. The kids keep smiling at each other, they keep being friends, there's not physical damage, that that's really healthy and important part of the developmental process of play. At the other end of the spectrum, I think if we were to take research and development division of a major company that is concerned that they're not getting fresh ideas, and there is a lack of safety in the organization because they're cutting back on personnel, or there are deadlines that are really heavy, to begin to introduce some kind of play state that is allowed each highly productive research person in their own particular temperament and personality leads to greater output and greater innovativeness. So that's sort of at one end of the spectrum. And if you were to take some of the other practical aspects of play, if you go into a nursing home, for example, with a high incidence and prevalence of dementia, and you bring in pets or little kids, and there is this mutual capacity to translate play signals between patient and volunteer, there often will be a raising of mood and a lessening of some of the morbidity that's associated otherwise with some of those very difficult circumstances. So I hope that answers your question.
Seems to me that play can be divided in maybe two or three categories. One is interpersonal play, one is person-animal play then, and one is sort of solitaire, like hobbies or card games or something solitaire. What are sort of the implications of the different types of play in terms of development and social and whatever?
Yeah, I don't think there's any one ideal form of play. I think it's really important for kids in particular to involve themselves in three-dimensional gravitational tug play where the cerebellum of the brain gets stimulated and they get some prefrontal firing up of higher centers from that sort of play. But apart from that, temperaments vary so much that what may be play for one kid may be an isolated fantasy. You saw the picture of Heidi in her loft. For her, that may be an ideal form of playfulness because that's her supposed temperament. Whereas another little kid will have to have five other kids around and be organizing some sort of mayhem in order to play. So there are huge differences in play personalities and play temperaments. And yet for each, the play is important. I do think there is in studying the severely deprived, there is a kind of a developmental minimum that kids have to play. And most of them, unless they're as suppressed as Whitman was, find it.
Can you define the interrelationship between humor and play, or is one just a form of the other?
I think they both have a kind of an unexpected quality. You know, the punchline in humor is a kind of a surprise. And usually if you're chasing someone and they're dodging around, which direction they go is a surprise. So the part of the essence of play from my standpoint is that there is an unexpected, random, non-stereotype quality that makes it fun. I hope that's useful.
Any other questions? No more questions? Okay.
Our thanks to Dr. Brown for his comments here today. We also thank our audience here, as well as those listening to the recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 106th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.